How did you end up on PEI?
Well, we originally were in BC. We started, I guess, a back to land thing, if that's what you want to call it, in BC. We first went to and lived helped organize and started a commune. It was built around oyster culture, and we were there for about a year, my family and I, and that wasn't particularly successful for a variety of means. We left and moved and lived outside Victoria up the Highlands on a small piece of acreage. Wanted more, and we found that we wanted more land. Looked around all over BC, and there was nothing that was really appropriate. So we made some decisions and sold everything, loaded up our family in a Volkswagen van, and started traveling east. Just out of curiosity, I had the only acquaintance I had in the east was a fellow I was in graduate school with, who was at Sackville, at Mount A, teaching there. But actually, it turned out I never did meet him. But we talked a little bit before we left. Anyhow, we thought we would come look around Atlantic Canada, see if we found some place that suited us. And if not, we would either sell the van and go to Europe, or else drive down through the U.S. and then Mexico and come back in B.C. and start over broke again. So, anyhow, we took about 3.5 months traveling across Canada, just poking around. It was an experiential trip for our kids. I couldn't even have told you where Prince Edward Island was when we left. It was that much of Western. We were headed for Cape Breton in about October. And we said, oh, well, looking at the map, we thought, well, you go on one ferry and drive down and come off on the next one. So we took the one ferry and never left. That was 34, 35 years ago. We found our family was tired of traveling by that time, and the weather was changing. And we found a place to rent for the winter and started looking around for land. Found a place that was ideal for us in South Banville, and bought it, and over the winter cut wood, hauled it to the mill, made windows, made doors, that kind of stuff, and moved on with new tents in the spring.
Are you originally from BC?
No, I was raised in Alberta.
Okay.
I moved to BC. My background trainings in fisheries management, aquatic biology.
Okay.
I'm a field biologist.
Okay. So that's what you were doing in grad school when you
got
to get from. Okay. And was back to land, is that a term you guys actually used, or is that something that we're imposing on you in retrospect?
I never thought it was a particular movement. Back to the land. I guess the more self-deprecating one was hippie call me weirdo freaks.
What first drew you to the West, though? Because you're saying you're living this in British Columbia for a while.
Yeah. Well, I guess part of it. I got involved in field biology at first, I guess, was I just loved being outside. My whole life revolved around being in the outdoors. And I did aquatic field research, and then I went into management in BC, went into northern BC. And we had standard accoutrements. We had a house, three kids, dog, all that kind of stuff. And it was nice. It was a pleasant life, interesting. It was Prince George in northern BC was very development oriented and kind of redneck. But anyhow, eventually I got like all good things. I did that work to be outside, to be in nature, and be involved with. As you got better at it and got a little bit older and got more experience, you end up having staff doing all the good stuff, and you end up in the office and managing budgets and personnel and all that kind of crap. We weren't as happy with our life as we wanted to be, and we actually just kind of by chance became involved with some people who were looking for the same kind of change. It wasn't farming or agriculture. We wanted to. We knew we had to make an income of some kind, and we looked around for ways to do that. And there was no kind of advanced oyster aquaculture there. So a group of us bought some land on one of the Gulf Islands, the Skeeby Island, and moved there and started. It was very successful business-wise. It wasn't as successful from a social point of view, so I was. By that time we got to become involved with other people who were doing a more an agriculture oriented thing, and we liked that. So
you mentioned you first stopped on PEI because you more or less got tired of traveling and winter was starting. What that made you stay?
Well, I would be untruthful if I said that probably. If I didn't say it, probably a primary factor was a 50-acre farm for $6,200, half cleared and half in hardwoods, lovely rolling hills, springs, great building sites, and then plus at that time, this was what, early 70s. We rented an old farmhouse in the Baltic. As it turned out, the people who it was empty. It had been broken into. The people who owned it were farmers in the area, and they were very happy to have somebody there. And we became quite good friends with them. We ended up there was an older couple who owned the place. We got to the point where they became quite good friends. They liked us. That we ended up looking after stock for them. Was at the place, and they were confident enough that they hadn't had a holiday in 40 years. They asked us to look after their farm while they went to Florida for the first time in their lives. So people were keen on what we were doing. The agriculture was still pretty simple and still kind of recognizable. They had a small mixed farm, beef, some dairy, some potatoes, that kind of stuff. So we learned a lot from them that winter we were there.
So when you first came, you had the land in South Granville, but you rented in Baltic?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just for the winter, from October. So we moved into tents on the site middle of May.
And is this the land that you kept for a while?
We had that land. We had that land for over 30 years.
Okay. So what did you end up doing with all that land?
Our intent was, I should explain. Well, we had, my wife and I, three kids. Our intent was to be self-sufficient. We assumed that we would have to make a living doing other things, working off the farm or developing craft skill, anyhow. And we did. We were very self-sufficient. We never used machinery, used horses. We had livestock. Subsistence livestock, chickens and pigs and cows and goats and all that kind of stuff. We raised our own forage. At one point in time, we raised our own grain. We're milling it for wheat for bread and all that kind of stuff. As an example, one year, well, we didn't have power. The van died, and we didn't have a car for about 4 or 5 years. We lived very, very completely self-sufficiently. One year, just as an example, we built almost double the size of the house. It was a 24 by 20, I think, house originally. We almost doubled the size of it. And that year, our entire income, including family allowance, everything else, was about $2,300. Um, so That was for a number of years. At one point in time, I started looking around for work, and I ended up actually working for a doing research and background work for a small farms program in Angus McLean Days, the executive council office, and that from there I started realizing that there was some, and in my own way realizing there was some possibilities for market gardening and different stuff. So for a number of years, probably 12, 15 years, we grew market gardens. At one point we had a maximum about 6 acres in high intensity raised bed narrow row agriculture, and that was in a rotation with sheep and whatnot. Was all certified organic. We were some of the first, I think probably about the second or third certified organic growers on PEI back in those days. So anyhow, that made us either haul or a good chunk of our income. It was labor intensive work. We grew a lot of very different stuff. We were the first herb growers on PEI. We grew things like peppers and squash and melons and all that kind of stuff, plus a lot of tree fruits, and did a lot of processing and value added stuff. So did all that kind of stuff for a number of years. Interesting now to hear about people having brand new insights and doing the same thing today. It's all new and exciting. It's great. Anyhow, then as family grew, our needs changed. Our labor force left. And we had to make some decisions about what we're going to do. By that time, I'd started, I worked part-time for the small farms program, which was active in, I don't know if you're familiar with it, it was active in PEI for 10, 15 years as an extension agent for them. And then moved from there into doing some consulting work periodically, usually through the winter. I'd take a contract or two and then go through the summer, kind of evolved out of that, and lived there for a number of years, and then I operated my own small consulting business out of that for a while.
Okay.
So that was sort of the evolution of how
it came out.
My wife died 9 years ago, and we've been the last number of years we lived there. Then we were pretty much back to being self-sufficient again, but did consulting work as an income source. We simplified a lot because we didn't need near so much. Put in power and put in the septic system and a well system as opposed to using the springs and stuff. So.
When did you get around to putting in the power and stuff?
It was only when we got to the point where we needed a better quality of water. We couldn't do it when we were doing more processing, selling product, and we couldn't get the water quality that we needed from the spring.
Was it for the market garden?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was the key thing. Plus, we were without power for so 15 years probably.
Was that because it was that choice? Because it was, well, was the conscious decision, or was it just a matter of not bothering to get around to put it in? Sometimes people make that distinction with me.
Well, the actual decision was kind of an interesting one. We had assumed we would get power just because of it, we built right in the, it was in a very sheltered valley right in the middle of our property, so it was almost a kilometer to the road. We would have had some expense for poles and whatnot, and of course, we ran out of money at some point in time. Also, though, I guess the major consideration was when we went to get a building permit for our house, the Old Town Road, from the Devil's Punch Bowl up to South Granville, ran through our property, and it had been degazetted as a road and declared was handed over to parks. And they had said they weren't sure they were going to let us cross the road, and so we said, well, we're going to do that anyhow. It's our property. You can't keep us off it. And they said, well, we want to see if we don't get a building permit. We said, well, we'll build a building permit. And they said, well, you can do that, but we'll block the hydro thing, the power thing, and we'll come across the... So we said, well, piss on, we'll have no electricity. We will start it. And then once we realized we could, you know, get along with it. And once we got used to it, it wasn't bad at all. And, you know, we always entirely used wood for heat and for cooking. We had springs and we had gravity and all those possibilities for gravity for heat most of the year, freezing in the wintertime. But, and, you know, those worked. So, anyhow, once we got kind of comfortable with it, that's what, but then as we got more successful and you know, had more income and like I say, the need for higher quality water was the primary one. So.
And one of the things that's come up in other interviews is your horses. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was talking to Roy Johnson, you mentioned bringing in your horses, trying to raise a tower and all that. What got you interested in keeping these are...
The draft horses. I always liked it. I never used draft horses. I'd ridden a lot out west, and I'd packed, loaded pack horses, and had pack strings, or been involved with pack strings, never owned them, but I've been involved in on hunting trips, doing some work, and did some fossil collecting work in miles with pack horses there. So I had some familiarity around horses, but I'd never harnessed one. And actually, this the old fellow who we lived with for his winter, he still used horses to haul manure in the wintertime. So I went and worked with him and learned how to harness horses and how to handle some draft horses. And then in the end, I paid. I don't know if you know Junior Chapel. I raced chapels in North Randall were horse race. For a while he shod my horses for me in the wintertime, but one time I had enough of that and just told him that I was ready for him to stand beside me. I'd pay him what he wanted, but he wanted me to stand beside him and tell me how to do it, and I'd shod my own horses and went on. So I shod my own horses. I learned how to weld so I could weld corks on the shoes, that kind of stuff.
Okay. And that's, how many horses did you end up having?
A lot of it was geared to a single big horse, but I used teams. I'd always have, and we had a road when we didn't have a car. We had either the sleighs in the wintertime or a cart that we, a cart and wagon. And I used them in the woods all the time. Pretty much single horse. I always had a road horse. It was a tough little pony, a pony draft horse cross we had. We'd take into the store and I used mostly single Belgian, but I always had the team available.
Mm-hmm. But having a team available, you owned the team?
I owned the team, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so there would be, we usually had three horses, sometimes four around the place.
And they're all Belgians?
No, one was the road horse. She was a cross between a heavy pony. She would look a lot like what they call a Canadian. I'd have a team of Belgians and sometimes we'd have another. Quite often I would be either the kids would have a horse or quite often I'd take one on contract and train it over the winter. I'm not a broken horse.
This is around the time when the horse culture seemed to really be fading, right? I mean, people have pretty much shifted over to equipment.
When we first started, there was still... Even in that area, Mayfield, Stanley Bridge, Randall, where we were and stuff, there's still a lot of horses around. Mostly they were race horses, but a lot of the older people still kept a horse for the winter to clean their stables. There wasn't a lot of stable cleaners and stuff around, so they'd use the manure spreader and tractor in the summertime, but they'd still keep a horse around for hauling the winter, so because it, that was easily doable with a with a barn where you only had maybe 25 or 30 head of stock.
Did you start up a horse association on PS? Or
no, I was involved in it. The one draft was, so the first draft horse association, I don't know if it's still in existence or not, but I was involved in that to begin with.
Okay.
Reggie Arsenal was also, I don't know if you've heard of him or anything, but he's really, he came back here about the same time. He was from Evans Village originally. He traveled all over the world. He came back, he and I became good friends. We were both horse farmers. Mm. Reggie lives in Guadalupe now.
Really?
Yeah.
So what other kind of animals did you keep?
Well, so always, to be self-sufficient, we always kept a milk cow. We breed her. We breed her to a beef breed, usually an Angus. So we milk her so she's fresh in the spring and late spring usually. And usually we kept the goat so that when the cow, we dry the cow off about the time the goat freshens, so that we milk in the interim. And there'd be a couple of goats we'd see. Most of the time we had a few sheep, small sheep flock around. Sometimes a half a dozen, we'd sell the odd land, and mostly we'd eat a fair bit of that. We'd always have at least two or three pigs a year. For a while we kept a sow and bred her, and chickens and whatever else.
Yeah. So what's the...
Well, rabbits, that's the other thing. Had a lot of rabbits. That's the other thing when you don't have refrigeration, when they don't have power, you don't have refrigeration. You want to be self-sufficient, you tend towards gearing a lot of your livestock production towards single meal. So you can kill a chicken in the morning and eat dinner, or a rabbit. So we raised a lot of rabbits.
So you're self-trained in butchering and all that? So.
Yeah, so we did all our own butchering, yeah. Kill a beef and usually late October, November, when the weather was cool enough to get hanged for 10 days.
Okay. What was the response of locals when you got here?
Interesting. The first response was the locals were there was lots of bets going on around North Granville about how long we'd last.
Encouraging.
We didn't know about that during that time, and we were hopelessly naive. Both my wife and I were very capable. Life skills and stuff. There's still lots we didn't know. there's that going on for a while. We ended up staying for a few years, and once we got some credibility, there was neighbors who were always interested and curious about us, and we became very good friends. And in fact, a lot of them were very helpful to us, and we worked back and forth. The nearest farmer was about a mile away. We lived the way the farm was located. It was situated. It was at the back of the farms. It was kind of running parallel or at right angles to the other property line. There was enough old farmers around who were... I did a fair bit of leather work. I made some bit of income at leather work. Pretty soon the farmers were hauling back their homes to get repaired and one thing or another. I used to work back and forth for a few years I worked as hired hand for a farmer down the way. We had a very large dairy herd, and he found out that I knew how to handle saddle horses, because prior to that time, when they moved cattle, they'd gather up all the new kids and shut all the gates and run around and pay if they wanted to move cattle. Once he found out I knew how to use a saddle horse and how to cut cattle, and I became a favorite around the neighborhood. When the cattle would be sold, they'd truck a horse and me over to do the work for them. And so your credibility got grew, and we'd work back and forth. When this farmer would borrow his tractor whenever I had some heavy work to do, I'd haul wood for him over time with the horses. So.
Gonna ask what the reaction was in town, but if you didn't have a car, you probably weren't going.
We were back and forth to town for a few years, okay. And then later on, once we got a car, there was a Well, he tended to move in certain circles in town. Mm-hmm. There was, there was the Root Star and the bookstore and the library and other people you knew who were similar, mid-depressed living in town, but they were hippie weirdo freaks too. So the other people, actually people here were really, really easygoing and quite accepting. I was compared to when on the West Coast, it's quite a little bit different. Although the hippies there were more, perhaps more in people's faces, and there was more confrontational. It was much gentler and more pleasant.
Did it take long to find like-minded people? Other people living this way?
No, not really. There was enough of them around that, actually when we found the property that we ended up buying, we were in the summer side at Jack's Meats, just kind of doing some shopping, and when you dress and look like you, was this woman we struck up a conversation with, and told her what we were doing, and she told us about Robert Jorgensen had a lot of land for sale there, and it was through them, just through that association, we found the empty farm we wanted. And that solved it. And in fact, sometimes we found, because we had a young family, they were all going to school, the kids were going to school. We found that sometimes that kind of back to land group became almost too cliquey for us. We enjoyed the community. We enjoyed learning from other people and talking with them and being friends with them. So.
Is there anyone very close to where you were?
Back to land?
Yeah.
Oh, Roy Johnson was there.
Oh, okay, yeah. Was St. Patrick Road area?
He lived in St. Patrick's Road. We lived we lived on the Granville Road.
Right, sure.
St. Patrick's Road was just around the corner.
Okay.
Molly and Paul Bell were over on Trout River Road. Other people moved in over time, and then there was something with the whole collection of people on the Dixon Road.
Right, okay.
So, Embered Alvin then was still pretty much it. They're going concerned, so there's going to be a lot of commonality around there.
Okay. You mentioned working for Angus McLean. Did you have any interaction with him while working on a small farming program?
Yeah, it was really interesting. I decided I needed work, and I had met a professor at NCPI. And started hustling in for some kind of bit of a job. He ended up being involved with David Wheel was the executive secretary of Angus, and Angus had wanted to start this research project to do a small farm, so they hired three of us, and we worked out of the executive council office in the back room there, and did about 6 or 8 months of field research, plus I did a fair bit of the office and library research, and put together a report that originated the small farm program. We made a presentation to cabinet, the progress report at one point in time, and we were on our way out the door, and his secretary came up to us and said he would like us to have tea with him in his office. So that was the first meeting with him, and then we became reasonably good friends. We used to stop by and visit. He visited us a few times. We became quite good friends. At its peak, the small farm program had about 10 or 12 extension agents around the province. They were all smaller part-time farmers, and they worked part-time in the community. And basically, what our research showed that small farmers, not just hippie weirdo freaks, but even all of the cream producers and all that kind of stuff, Yeah, very little involvement with the Department of Agriculture and with any of the services that the province had. So a good part of our work was just to go around, talk to them, get to know them, find out what their needs were, and make sure that they had access to the department. And we ran a lot of interference for the department, who didn't really think very highly of. They were just doing everything they could, doing everything along with, development plan philosophy, to get them all the hell out of there and get things changed around to updated and modernized. And we worked the opposite way, so we worked with the department as well, trying to making sure they started to understand what was going on and the need. Anyhow, it was an interesting group of people. Some of them were old, retired farmers. A number of them were sort of the same bent as we were. We were sort of back in land, at least attitudes and types. So it was a pretty good mix.
And these are the people working for Extension?
Yeah.
Okay, so you weren't the only Vectolander in the
group? No. I guess probably 40% of us would have been. The other 60% would have been normal small farmers who had interest or had some knowledge of the department. Mm.
Did Angus ever make any comments about the whole lifestyle? Did you ever kind of ever get talking to him about why you came here, anything like that?
Yeah, we did. He wasn't judgmental about it either positively or negatively. He recognized that it was fresh and it was new and it was kind of beneficial. Sometime later on, I was the small farm program was supposed to have a limited lifespan. I mean, basically, there's so many small farmers, you get them all involved with the department in one way or another, or government generally, and you do what you can to. I think we had a lot to do with cream producers and helping them to be better at what they did and stuff. Anyhow, at some point in time, theoretically, you become redundant. But it, like most bureaucracies, it took on a bit of a life of its own. I was doing some work for the Department of Agriculture on a consultant basis. They asked me to have a serious look at it and see whether it was even rationalized it continuing on. This was under Gears' government. Angus heard what I was doing. He was long retired, but still he called me, asked me if I wanted to see him, and we had a long talk about his views on it, and he was quite concerned that it was going to be phased out, killed, and in the end it was. But he had a lot of concerns about that, and in the end we had a pretty strong discussion about what should happen with it, and we both compromised.
Thinking about what you said earlier, when you were living in BC, it was more of a communal.
Well, at first, but then when we left that, we wanted something of our own. We wanted land.
Yeah.
BC, in reality, although it's pretty mild climate, one another, about 4% of the land is arable. Most of that's been taken for a long time. We looked all over BC, and there's a lot of back of the landers in the Kootenays and Up Island and other places. Most of them are pretty pathetic. I mean, they might have had an acre or so. The land is pretty poor. All the bottom land had been long gone, with the exception of some of the bottom land in the Kootenays. A lot of them were pretty hard scrabble operations. We wanted to seriously be self-sufficient, and we realized that what we could afford there after we looked all over the province pretty much, although we didn't want to go back north again. We, for a variety, that was our previous life in the north, and we didn't choose to go back to become involved in that, and because it was pretty big town, unavoidable. I traveled all over the northern half of BC, and there's too many people, you know, in a different life, you didn't want. So, what we could afford, we realized we would be about 500 years old before it was really, really, you know, productive. So, our whole family took we had this one place way out up above Port Hardy, a place called Saint-Tula, island off Vancouver Island, north of Port Hardy. And we thought this was a pretty good possibility. And when looked at it, and there was soil underneath you, but you couldn't even touch the soil because it was 5 feet of soil you were clambering around on. So we thought, it's not going to work. We got to do something else. And so we, with that decision, we packed up everything and left.
That's for PEI and the affordable land.
Oh yeah, $120 an acre. So
can't beat that.
No. That land has afforded us a pretty incredible life for 30 years, 30 plus years.
We're talking about how your home, you weren't on the grid for a long time. Did you toy with any technologies, such as windmills or something or anything?
We actually built a windmill. As time went on, keeping food became more of a problem. Actually, at one point in time, there used to be a little food locker in conjunction with the creamery at Crackle, for example. They ran a food locker for like $5 a month or something like that. So that made sense. You could catch a ride down there, and so when you did butcher, you could do that, and you could just preserve some vegetables and stuff. But anyhow, we missed music, and kids missed the television. So we ended up getting 12-volt system, and for the longest time I got a few great honking, the old Belarus tractors just have huge 12-volt batteries. I'd throw them on the sleigh and haul them down to the neighbors, and they'd pay them a few bucks a month for electricity I used to charge them. Made it really selective for the kids watching television because they knew I was listening to music because they knew you only had so much space, so didn't listen to a lot of crap. and then even inverters on the 12 volt to 120 to run our stereo system were really pretty elementary compared to what they are now. So I ended up building a simple little wind charger with an alternator off a car and hand carved blades and whatnot. Stuck it up by we used to have it near the shed. I had a shed up by the road so we could leave our horse there if we wanted to. We'd be able to use a horse and sleigh to go back and forth. Leave our car up there for the winter when we had a car. So anyhow, I put that on top of that, and that was how we charged the batteries, but that was great. That's what I don't really, it's handy, and it's nice, but much easier to go in. And it was also easier then, to get good quality kerosene for the lamps, and you could still buy Aladdin lamp parts and stuff here, and that kind of stuff. And didn't need... When you got a phone, you didn't need power for a phone. They ran a little trickle of electricity to the phone, to the phone lines to operate the phone.
So. I can maybe ask a couple more questions. There's two pop in mind. What's the social scene for somebody that's looking back to the land and, it's very unique in one respect, and maybe the mobility isn't the greatest. So were you socializing much with the crew in the Dixon Road, or were you mostly with people in Granville? that were
more with people in the Grand Prairie. People like Roy and Sigurd and even some of there was one farmer who moved from Switzerland. He was a young fellow, and he had a dairy farm. They were working, they had a commercial operation, but his head and heart were in kind of right places. So they became, they were good friends. But also, but most of our closest friends were people who were roughly our age, who were farmers and intermediaries.
What sort of difficult challenges did you have to face in this Bexhill lifestyle on PEI? Was there anything unexpected that popped out at you? Maybe moving in a little naive about it that you haven't had to deal with?
Well, the unexpected were, the unexpected were probably stuff unlearned. I mean, there were difficulties, physical difficulties. I mean, the first year we were so busy building a house, and then the wood got sort of, you'd be hauling out wood when the snow got deep on the toboggan, and the chainsaw broke down again, and then you'd cut it by hand and all that kind of. And learning to handle forage properly, and just acquiring life skills. It was always a challenge, there's always lots to learn. Kids adapted really well to it. They live very different lifestyles now, but they still look back in time. Being self-sufficient makes you very strong and independent. I don't mean physically strong, but kind of mentally strong coping skills are. But anyhow, I guess that the difficulties. There's the odd minor little difficulty with, some of the assholes in the neighborhood, but you face up to them and it's done.
Yeah.
that went quickly.
Okay. Is there anything you'd like to add that I didn't ask about? Maybe like to put across there.
Well, I don't know what direction your research goes. It's it was a really interesting, rewarding, and worthwhile experience. And I think about it certainly sets a tone for your entire life. And we have a very comfortable life now, but. All that's still there, and still, my daughter who lives in New Zealand now, so that, security for her is not money or investments or, being this foolish enough to think just because you put money in something, somebody's going to give you more back. Security for her is still always simplistic kind of plant potatoes, so, if you can instill those kind of values in your kids and that kind of comfort level, that's a pretty good, pretty worthwhile endeavor. Also, for us it was very much familial, even though we lived communally for a year or so, and actually there was a number of communes on the Skeety Island that had been in existence for several years, and we got there mostly craft dodgers. Some of them are still in existence, so they've changed and shifted and all that. But out of necessity, like I guess a lot of agriculture here, we did for a long time, created a very tight family, and that was very worthwhile.